Colonel Sir William Bolton, Reel 7. You're saying that you were asked about your practice pre-war. What had been your main experience in practice at the bar?
Well, the only thing I really got those days, you didn't expect to get much work for 4 or 5 years, really. But what one did was to go round to assizes and quarter sessions in the hope that you'd get a defence case. You were asked by the judge if you would defend X, who was due to come up in a couple of days or something. And for that you got paid 3 guineas.
Should be a doc brief.
No, well, a doc brief was different.
Doc brief was different.
A doc brief, anybody charged with an offence could say, I want a doc brief. And then the law was that he could look round the court and choose any counsel who happened to be in court. And the usual result was that while that was going on, everybody with a wig on put their heads down and crept out of court very quickly. If you got a doc brief, you only got 1 guinea. Oh. I think on the ordinary defence, in addition to 3 guineas, you've got something of half a crown for the clerk or something, or one. Some very small amount. And, I mean, virtually all I did were those sort of cases, and you could go around these courts and not get anything. And I was on the Northeastern Circuit, and I was mainly up in places like Leeds, Newcastle. And it was quite a trek from Essex, and often to no effect. The only lengthy case I had was on the civil side. There was legal aid, but there was no payment for it at all. But I had one case of a woman who was being sued for divorce on the grounds of adultery in a, what's the right word, when you wait for a bus on the side of a road, a bus shelter. In Bridlington, in Yorkshire. And it was defended because she, I think, proved that she had an illness called vaginismus, which made sexual activity virtually impossible. And it went on, I think, extraordinary thing, for at least 2 days. And I, of course, got paid nothing. And I think I lost the case, but I did learn a bit of advocacy.
When you joined the legal section in the Control Commission, what were you supposed to do? What were your orders and instructions?
Well, they said what to try and learn as much as we could before the war finished about the German legal system. And
how did you go about doing that?
Well, the main assistance was we managed to get the German legal brochures or magazines or whatever you call it. And that gave quite a lot of information, in particular exactly promotions of lawyers, judges, etc., prosecutors, etc. And the first important thing was to look out to see who'd had any sort of abnormal promotion, because that was an indication that there was some Nazi influence behind it.
How did
But we were also, there was a... A fairly senior member of the bar who was Jewish and had, I think he'd practiced in Germany and so on, and he, of course, really was a sort of a main teacher and told us a great deal that one could learn in that time.
Was the German system in any way similar to our own?
Not in the least.
Not in the least. What were the main differences?
Well, the German legal system is like the solar system, an extremely typical German of orthodoxy and logic. There'd be a Ministry of Justice. Each state had a sort of minor Ministry of Justice. Then underneath them were the top courts of appeal called Oberlandesgericht. Underneath Oberlandesgericht were Landgericht, which were equivalent to our High Court. And under each Landgericht were a number of Amtsgerichte, which were equivalent to county courts. And all those courts did both civil and criminal. And this in the British zone, I think there were 7 or 8 over Landesgerichtsbezirke. And it turned out that the only way of really getting going, doing something, was to select the best people you could find to be Oberlandesgerichtspräsident, in other words, president of these superior courts, because one of their main tasks was to appoint everybody below them.
I was going to ask how the Germans appointed their judges and their
Well, I'm
officials.
Not sure. I think the Oberlands probably appointed the Landgericht president, and they probably appointed the Amtsgericht. I couldn't be whether the Oberlandsgericht president's authority went beyond the Landgericht or not, but I'm sure he could stop anybody being appointed who he didn't like.
Was the intention to restore the German legal system as it had been before 1933?
Yes.
So that was it was a restorationist approach then.
Well, in actual fact, that it was extraordinary how small that particular problem was, because there really had been no important changes in the civil or criminal codes during the Hitler regime.
But the people had changed. Had the personnel changed?
Well, of course, obviously a lot had changed. But of course, everybody appointed to a judicial prosecution, as you know, in Germany, there are separate careers for private lawyers and the civil service. All judges and prosecutors are civil servants. Lawyers were, you know, more or less, not much different to ours. They were private, they acted for people privately.
The advocates?
Yes. Yeah.
Did they have a sort of system we had with solicitors and barristers, or did they have a joint profession?
No.
What about the People's Court that had been set up by the National Socialists?
Well, I mean, I think there was there were a few military government laws which were passed as from the day of occupation, and those such things were abolished straight off. I mean, without it, long before, you know, we didn't really have a problem there because they didn't exist by the time we were doing anything.
Did you have to conduct a sort of purge of active National Socialists from within the legal profession and the Beamter?
Well, that was basically done by the fact of the, I mean, who was head of it all, I don't know, by everybody had to, who had getting a job, had to sign a certificate or questionnaire called a Fragebogen, going into their past in some detail. And all that de-identification, it wasn't part of our job, that, at all. But they, of course, had to pass that before they could be appointed by the German authorities.
So were you basically in a supervisory role rather than an active role of management and control?
Well, we were more than that. Because we had to find out as far as we could what was going on in these courts.
Yes.
And also, there were no ministers of justice, so we set up one in Hamburg for the British zone. We didn't call it a minister of justice, we called it something else. But and then we also set up a court of appeal for the whole zone. Verfassungsgericht. On questions of constitution.
Constitutional law. How did you staff those institutions?
I can't remember about that particular court, but the whole thing started. We found, he was pretty elderly by that time. Oh, God. A a man called Kieselbach, who had been a prominent lawyer, and in Hamburg, the sort of Nazi influence would seem to be far less than anywhere else that we could find. And he was enormous help in finding these top appointments in the Oberlandesgericht, and we also put him at the head of this so-called Ministry of Justice. And there he remained, I think, was still doing at the time that when the first long as I was there. He was extremely able and pleasant individual. And I'm entirely, as I'm sure he's one of those people who kept their heads down during the Nazi regime.
Did you have to make or enforce any changes in procedure in these courts?
No. I think we asked for various information, we ordered them if they wanted particulars of exactly how many cases of so-and-so and so-and-so had taken place, that these courts must produce those figures. But one of the important thing we did was to set up an additional court system to try prominent Nazis, the members of about three or four different organizations, like the Gestapo, of course, but I can't remember the others, but there were two or three others. And we appointed judges. The people we dealt with, the Germans, were quite willing to staff those courts and were staffed. And they tried an enormous number of cases and sometimes gave very hefty sentences. And we called it old lace.
Was that done under German law?
No, I think the trial was to prove whether they had been members of one of these organizations. And of course, if there was any aggravating circumstances and so on, that would be it would be their duty to report it.
Was that under a special law then, a new element in the code?
We didn't. I mean, there was no question of altering the criminal code to do this. So I think it must have been backed by an agreed law. Of course, actual laws were made in Berlin.
But yes.
There must have been something to back it, but I can't, my tiny hazy exactly.
I was going to ask you about the police, because I got the impression that in Germany, the police were actually supervised by the judiciary in a more direct way than had been the case in England.
Oh, I had no experience of that. I can't remember any time when we were sort of telling people that the police were misbehaving or something. Mm. I mean, I think some of the police were unreliable. For example, where we were in Hereford, there were an awful lot of burglaries, and
yes.
My impression was the police had something to do with it. I went chasing out one night with a revolver in hand when I we slept on the ground floor. I placed a piece of cotton across the drive outside the thing. When this went off at night with somebody creeping round, I went, there were two policemen hanging around.
How were you received and treated by the German lawyers and judges when you arrived?
Very good. The whole time, I can't think of any sort of unpleasant, possibly one and a half unpleasant accusation that we were doing something bad or silly, or that we weren't. I think there were sort of complaints we weren't getting on quick enough with setting up the things that had to be set up. But the one occasion, I was second in command of the branch, and the head of it was a a chap called Jack Rathbone, who has been a solicitor in public life, an extremely intelligent and able chap. And he, because we had we sent round members of our staff round to inspect certain courts and call for certain records and so on. And he went one of the nearest big town, Bielefeld, I remember. This is purely, of course, what he told us. And he walked into some court, and probably not in uniform. And the judge there said, "Rouse, get out!" So I made the rattle. He said, "You probably don't know who I am. I'm the head of the Ministry of Justice Control Branch with the authority of legal administration of the British." Whereupon this fellow sank on his knees and put his arms around Rathbone and had mercy.
What did Rathbone do?
That was the only case of its sort. The only other thing, I think we had a park to stay judgments. There were, I think, a couple of cases somewhere in the some place where, I've forgotten what the name of the Oval Landesgerichtsbezirk was, but some cases that looked as though two Nazis had been acquitted and so on. And we put a stop on that, and there was a great, there was an awful lot of opposition to that, and they put up enough evidence as a result that we withdrew our prohibition, but that was the only case, I think, the whole time.
How long did it take to get the system up and running again effectively?
Well, I think I think in some parts were quicker than others, but I think it must have been done within a year, I think. Of course, what was hopeless happened. Some of the advancing forces tried to open that local county called Amtsgerichte, but they came across a fellow who said he was a judge, and they liked the look of him, and they said, "Right, you go." And of course, that was a hopeless way of dealing with the whole thing. And so it was very quickly decided that the only way of dealing was the one I've told you, of doing it from the top.
Top down.
I think it must have taken between 6 months and a year to get the thing going more or less throughout. We only seem to have made one mistake over the Oberlandesgericht president. One fellow was appointed, and it turned out he'd sentenced a lot of communists, I think, to death a year or two before.
What happened to him? Was he sacked?
Well, I don't know. He was chucked out, but I don't know. I mean, we didn't order his execution or anything of that sort.
Who were you reporting to? Who was your section reporting to? Was it to the control commission as such? In Berlin?
Well, they... the head of the legal division was in Berlin.
Yes.
We had to report to him. But of course, he was in the zone very little, and so
he'd be out of touch, wouldn't he?
He would be in touch. Normal mid telephone work most of the time. But he would be kept more or less in touch with what was going on.
Did you have any liaison with the similar organisations in the American zone, the French zone, and the Russian zone?
Occasionally. But I can't remember the exact subjects were, but we had difficulties. I think we found the French quite impossible. And the Americans were much more difficult than we expected, because almost anything we asked them, they said, "Well, we haven't power here, we've got to refer back to Washington." Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is going to take a long time. Things which we would probably have done straight off the bat.
I mean, were you aware of there being a joint policy amongst the Allies in regard to this sort of activity, restoring judicial systems?
There must have been, yes, I wasn't involved myself with any of it. There must have been, I'm sure there were one or two meetings in which I think we did agree with the Americans on something, but I honestly, I can't remember at all.
Why were the French impossible? What was it that made them impossible?
That I can't remember. It's purely a sort of, it rings a slight bell. I can't support that with evidence, I think.
And what about the Russians? Did you?
Well, they were more impossible.
They were more impossible than the French.
But of course, they were in a. Of course, the French. Yes. Well, they had their zone, the whole of East Germany. And the only contact I can remember was they sent in teams to look around to see what stuff they could take to, you know, to take back to Russia.
For reparations.
Yes. And I can remember a place somewhere in the Ruhr. Well, we were staying the night in a pub, and this Russian team were there as well. And staying in there also was a fairly senior, I think a major or colonel of the British Army, who was a name was quite well known, but it's out of my mind at the moment, who was a sort of previous Russian aristocrat, I think, and talked perfect Russian. And I can remember a meeting down in the bar. And this chap, this Russian, started talking to this Russian team. I don't know quite what he said to them, but they immediately took fright and disappeared. Never saw them again. But they were impossible in Berlin. I mean, whatever was proposed, it was always near, no good. And I can only remember one story that illustrates that, and again, pure hearsay. That somebody on the economic side for the British legal division decided to invite his Russian opposite to supper one night, which he did. And I think he found it a bit boring to know what to discuss. I imagine the language presented a bit of a problem. But he remembered a trick, which I don't know if we've ever heard of. If you've got a jacket on like you have, with fairly stiff stuff, you can take a matchstick and you can press it into a bulge, and if you do it right, the matchstick will jump out quite a long way. Well, he did this, the Russian, he was absolutely fascinated. And so fascinated, he went on till about midnight showing him how to do this. And after that, so the story went, that for a time the answer was yes, yes, yes. But I think the fellow disappeared pretty quickly from that section of in Berlin.
You were saying that you started out as a soldier on the, in this service, and then you became a civilian. How did that happen?
Well, I think quite simply. I mean, I was due for demobilisation, I think in 96. Sometime, and I've forgotten exactly the, how it went in correspondence, but I was, anyway, it was immediately fixed that I would be demobilised, that I would then be appointed by the Foreign Office to go on doing the same job.
So it made no difference to the work you were doing day to day?
None at all, no. And of course, the other people in the division, I think the same thing, or else they hadn't been in the forces, there was no problem about that.
So it was a smooth transition from soldier to civilian.
The only thing is, you couldn't go on. Not that I ever used it, but I mean, if you could say I'm Colonel so and so, you might get a. quicker and better result than if you were a pure civilian.
Where were you living at this time when you were on the commission?
Well, it was all in this a place called Hereford.
Yes.
In Westphalia, which is the nearest big town was Bielefeld. I think the actual I actually started in Baden-Oeynhausen, which was military headquarters for a very short time, and then Lübeck, which is about 12 miles away, for another very short time. But 95% of the time was in Hereford. But of course we were travelling round a lot, all these different places.
What happened to you then when it came to an end? How did you become a pure civilian, as it were?
Well, I thought I just answered that question.
No, I mean, how did you come to leave the commission?
Well, it was obvious that it wasn't going to last forever. Practice at the bar, from what I could find, seemed to be not much better than it had been before. I saw an advertisement for secretary of the bar council and put in for it, and I had to go over for an interview and so on, but then got the job with a point. At a mighty salary of $1,500 a year.
What do you think are the advantages of having served in the army? What benefits did you derive?
I think it was helpful in the sense of, and learned a lot of administration. And one was, the office was pretty well chaotic in the bar council. And one had various experiences which did call for a measure of administrative ability, and I think I did get a lot of that from, and which has served me even later, and things like choosing filing systems, and that sort of thing, correspondence, how to keep it, and all that sort of thing was a help. I don't think so.
Did you keep up your connection with the Essex Yeomanry after you had left them?
Not really, because of course I couldn't. A lot of officers did, but I couldn't do it because I was too far away. But I did, in fact, keep on my status as a territorial officer, because I remember I did some training with a local regular army gunner regiment in Westphalia, or in Hanover, I think near Hanover. But that was all.
That would have been refresher training, presumably.
Well, I remember it was there's a training place between Hamburg and Hanover, about halfway. Name I forget offhand. It's sort of the country where you could practice artillery and so on. I remember doing that, and it was a week's training there. Then really there was much object in it, but I think I got a bar to my territorial decoration probably by staying on.
That goes on length of service, doesn't it, basically?
Yeah, absolutely.